Good evening, and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm your host, Jeff Hayden. As we slowly inch our way to address the demands of everyday economic life after the coronavirus pandemic, we're happy to present to you tonight our annual program on tax preparation and filing tips. In recent weeks, we've had some great discussions and a lot of you called in. And as we reach to you into your homes and cars, we continue to shelter in place, broadcasting remotely via Zoom. As always, we welcome your calls. While we shelter in place, we seek normalcy, and we especially want to hear from you. If you have legal questions for my guests, hopefully not legal problems, if you have legal questions for my guests, if you want to tell us how the COVID-19 virus has affected you or your loved ones, your life, your jobs, your business, how government measures are working or not for you, where you might look for relief, or if you just want to talk to another human being, give us a call. Our phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, 415-841-4134. If you're outside of San Francisco, call us toll-free. That number is 866-798-8255. Again, toll-free, 866-798-8255. As always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topic being tax preparation or any related legal question you have. You're not limited to the exact point we may be in our conversation. Occasionally, I do neglect to mention that while we're happy to answer all of your questions, we stop short of giving precise legal advice as we don't have all the facts related to a given case. However, we're more than happy to pass along the legal principles that can and perhaps should guide your decision-making. Joining us tonight are attorneys, accountants, CPAs, Frank Adam and David Hellman. David Hellman is an experienced attorney and CPA. He's been doing this program for many, many years, both with Chuck Finney and later with me. And with offices in Pacifica, Frank Adam, an attorney and CPA and real estate broker, has also supported this program, as well as our Call a Lawyer Night, for many years. Both of our guests have been very generous with their time and are anxious to answer your questions. But let me pause for a moment, and first, Frank, David, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thanks, Jeff. You have questions tonight. Our toll-free number is 866-798-8255. And David, Frank, last year when we spoke, there were major changes to tax law that we were then trying to digest. What is new now as of the end of 2019?
Well, there have been several changes, actually. At the end of last year, 2019, they passed the SECURE Act as part of the budget. That's made major changes to retirement plans and some other things. And then with these new coronavirus bills that have come through, there have also been several tax changes and updates. I don't know if Frank has other comments.
The one comment I have initially is regarding the payroll protection loans. I don't know if you want to get to that now, but I do think there's, for those that have taken advantage of this, there are probably a couple of, I would say, more accounting points than tax points that need to be addressed. I don't know if you want to do that now or later.
I see no time like the present.
Okay, well, I've had two clients that have participated in the payroll protection loans, and I've given both of them the same advice, and that is with regard to the money that they receive from the loans. I think it would be a very wise idea, or a very good idea, if I'm not overstating it, to isolate the funds received from the loan in a separate bank account, checking or savings account, and then make sure that those funds are used for the appropriate purposes. It would, because I think at some point, if there's an audit or an inquiry, the government will engage in something called tracing. And as long as you can trace the money in from the loan and out for the appropriate expenditures, it might make answering that inquiry or audit a lot easier. And the second point I want to make is more tax-related than anything else. And it's my understanding that if the loan is forgiven, then the amount, the money spent for what would otherwise be deductible expenses will not be deductible. So while there may be a loan forgiveness of 100%, the lack of the tax deduction for those expenses will result in additional tax.
Yeah, although the Congress is looking at possibly changing that, but right now the IRS has said that that is the case.
Is this whole thing a bit of a moving target right now?
Extremely. I think the laws are changing very quickly. It was rolled out very, very quickly. The funds expired or were not expired, but they ran through the funds very quickly. So I imagine that the procedures pertaining to both the tax and accounting of this will evolve, to put it mildly.
Yeah, I mean, every day I'm getting two or three announcements of specific things that they're either coming out with or changes. So it is evolving regularly.
Let's circle back to taxes. Normally, we would have had this show quite a bit earlier, and of course, we got bumped off the air with the shelter in place. But here we are having this discussion in May, late May at that. Can you give us an update on filing deadlines? Obviously, they're not April 15th. Were both the state and federal deadlines extended uniformly, or are there different dates this year?
You know, they've both been extended to July 15th, and that includes filing and payment. It didn't happen all at once, but that's where it is now.
I know at one point they were telling us you still have to pay by April 15th, but you don't have to file till July. So that's changed?
Yes. Payment is now July. And that includes for the returns and the first and second quarter estimated tax payment vouchers.
What about penalties and interest and things like that? Have those been forgiven, or those don't start accruing until the 15th of July?
That's correct. They don't start until July 15th.
Now, one of the things that obviously we just talked about, the payment deadlines or the filing deadlines, has the coronavirus pandemic otherwise affected tax preparation this year? It's obviously going to next year.
Well, in a manner of speaking, at least with regard to my practice, it allows me to spread out the work a little bit more. There are people who or clients that normally wait till the very last minute to do the returns, and this year, because of the extension, many of the clients are, while they're taking their time, they're getting the information to me well ahead of the July 15th deadline. So I've actually been able to do returns in a more leisurely way. So in that sense, I'm happy about it. What I don't want to see happen is we get down to July 15th and people have used the extension to do even more procrastinating. That I imagine that's going to happen to varying degrees depending on the practitioners.
So one of the things that we're all dealing with as we're all living in Las Vegas these days, we're all taking losses. Hopefully we're not all drinking 24/7, but we are taking some losses. How much of that's going to apply this year? Do some of the credits earned or losses apply now, or is it none of it going to affect us until next year?
Are you talking about investment losses?
Whether it's investment losses. Exactly. If we take investment losses in the first few months of this year for things such as our retirement accounts and the like, that perhaps contributions would have been something we could deduct. What about losses? Are any of those something we could reach to this year?
Well, with respect to the investment losses in a retirement account, those losses aren't going to be directly deductible. For those people that have required minimum distributions, the losses may result in a smaller required minimum distribution, but with regard to brokerage accounts, if there's a loss and it's more than a paper loss, in other words, people have seen the losses in their securities and then decide to liquidate those securities, that will come in as an actual loss and will be limited, assuming there are no gains involved, limited to the normal $3,000 per year. And I don't know that rule has changed. David, have you heard anything about that? I have not.
That has not changed.
Okay.
While you did mention retirement plans also, they've also postponed people having to take a required minimum distribution this year. They have also, the SECURE Act also upped the age from 70 and a half to 72 for having to take required minimum distributions.
So when we first started the program, David, you had mentioned that there were some changes at the end of 2019 that are going to affect how we proceed. Can you talk to us a little bit about some of the things that are going to look different this year?
Well, it's mainly this SECURE Act that we've just started talking about. It relates to retirement plans. So that's the primary area. There was about 20 different items that got changed in relation to retirement plans.
So let's start from the beginning. How would you approach things this year differently than in years past, or would you approach it differently? I come to you for the first time. I'm running a small business or professional practice, and I'm really looking to see where to start.
Well, I think the basic items have not changed. You need to have your data well organized, summarized. You need to be in a position where you know what income you've received, what expenses you had. Hopefully you've got enough money to pay any tax liability that will be due. One of the positive things, as Frank mentioned, about the deferral of the dates to July, it gives us more time to prepare returns, and it gives clients more time to get money together to help pay things if that's really where they end up.
Last year, we had some significant changes we lost several of the deductions, but most people, individuals, faced that didn't itemize. Their standard deduction was quite a bit bigger. For small businesses, I know the government took 20% off the top and started from your income there. Those were pretty significant changes. Have we seen anything remotely like that this year?
Well, I think the law with regard to those things is pretty consistent. The standard deductions have increased a little bit. They've been, but they have the doubling of the deductions since 2018. That's still in place. And in my practice, I've actually prepared several. Or last year, for preparing for the 2018 returns, for several of my wealthier clients. Just for purposes of comparison, I prepared the 18 return under the 17 law, and I didn't have one client that paid more income tax. Everybody paid less, and the alternative minimum tax was far less applicable to individuals. In fact, I don't think I had one individual client get hit with AMT. So in that regard, the law was quite good. I know there were a lot of complaints about the deductibility of or non-deductibility of state and local and property taxes, but the increase in the standard deduction did offset that for many people.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM. I'm Jeff Hayden. Tonight we're discussing the preparation, filing, and payment of your taxes. Joining me tonight are Pacifica attorney, accountant, realtor, Frank Adam, and San Rafael attorney, CPA, David Hellman. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're calling from outside of the local dialing area, that for most of us is if you're calling from outside of San Francisco, you should call us toll-free. We'll pay the freight. That number is 866-798-8255. And again, that's 866-798-8255. As always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topic or any question relating to tax filing or tax preparation. You're not limited to where we might be in our conversation. We're not certainly limited to this exact point. We've spent the time thus far talking about changes in the federal tax filing and programs. Any significant changes in the state?
Not really that I've seen. I don't know if Frank has seen anything.
No, I agree. State law has been fairly consistent. The only comment I would make is that the lack of conformity between California and federal causes more work for the preparer, whether it's the individual or a paid preparer. You've got to make sure that you're doing things correctly under California law, and that's going to be much different than federal law on most, if not on most issues, not all of them, but most of them.
There was a time, even as recently as a few years ago, where it seemed like most of the policies were aligned. You could carry things pretty much from one to the other. Are those days behind us for the time being?
What do you mean by that, Jeff? I'm not sure.
It seemed like most things that you would enter were reasonably parallel between the state and federal tax returns. And it seems in recent years there's been more and more deviation.
Well, that's true. From a preparer standpoint, we enter the federal tax information, and then here in California, we make those adjustments either on the state return manually, or the programs that are out there sometimes do it automatically, but not always. It's just that there are more of those adjustments to make now than there were in the past. The most obvious example is the state and local tax deduction limitation on the federal side, which is not applied to the state side, at least with regard to the property and local taxes.
We do have a caller on the line. Let me turn it over to Steve in San Francisco. Steve, you're on Your Legal Rights. Welcome.
All right. Well, thank you guys very much. This is an excellent program and is very timely. I help out an elderly person who used to be a colleague of mine, and they always ask me every year, do they have to file taxes? I think their only source of income is Social Security and maybe a small amount for retirement. So there's probably a lot of people that are tuning in or wondering, below what amount do you not have to file for your taxes if you're over 65? And I think it's a portion of Social Security is counted or not counted towards that amount. Is it like $25,000,
$35,000? So I've heard a couple of different questions kind of put in there. Let me break it down a little bit.
You got it.
Something, tell me. But it seems like the two questions that I got were, one, is there a minimum threshold under where the income below that doesn't have to be reported or you don't have to file taxes?
Right.
And the second question had to do with Social Security and whether independently if there's a minimal amount that you don't need to report, or does that trigger you having to file?
It sounds great. Thank you, guys. It's a big public service. I'm going to do a donation to ALW with the amount that
we're going to save from the help keep us
thank
on the
you.
David, Frank, who had a chance to hear that and follow through?
All right, so for a person over 65, and I'm looking at 2019, not 20, but and I think that the table for 2019 is you did not need to file a return if your income was below $13,850, and I think it's probably $13,900 for 20. That's for federal. For California, it's a lower amount, but California does not tax Social Security at all. The federal only taxes Social Security if you do get up to $25,000 of other income. So if the person has a small pension, chances are they're probably, and below that level, they're probably not going to need to file for federal, and chances are they're probably going to also evade having to file the amount that you needed for the state.
Because one thing I want to add to that, if a person does fall below the income limits for filing, they may still want to file if with regard to their pension income, federal or state taxes have been withheld, because you want to get those taxes back. You want to get that withholding back.
Right.
So you may not
have zero, and you still have a withholding. You've got a refund coming.
Right. Right. So you may not have to file, but it may be to your advantage to file because of the refunds.
There's another part of the question that when Steve first called, we had some technical issues with his call, and he voiced another part of it earlier, which was wondering if there's any different rules for the elderly because of the pandemic.
No, there's nothing that's changed there.
Not to my knowledge.
So do either of you have specific information on some of the relief programs? We mentioned the PPP earlier. That's the Paycheck Retention Program. But other programs offered, whether it's through EDD or the SBA or any of those?
Well, there's no EDD loan program or other benefit that I'm aware of. Frank may have some further information that I don't, but I'm not aware of anything there. The SBA has been focused on the PPP primarily. There are still other SBA programs, but the PPP is the primary one. And of course, the primary issues there are that to take advantage of it and have the loan forgiven, you need to spend at least 75% of the amount on payroll or state payroll tax costs. And it could also include benefits. And the other 25% you could spend on rent and utilities. But those have to be spent within 8 weeks of getting the funds. There is talk that Congress may extend that date also, but that hasn't happened yet. So again, these are sort of moving targets.
But right, I think with regard to the unemployment benefits, depending on how long someone is unemployed and how much they get, some portion of the unemployment benefits are going to become taxable. So going to be there may be some surprises as to the total tax bill, even though for people who are unemployed for some period of time, even if it's a relatively long period of time, depending on their total income.
Right. The federal tax scheme has always, it's taxed unemployment benefits. Not sure where all that's going this year. That may yet change. I don't think the supplemental benefits are going to be taxed, but the base unemployment may be.
Well, it gets really confusing with the Paycheck Protection Program, and I don't think there's an answer yet. But when you apply that to somebody who is self-employed without necessarily them writing paychecks to employees, it gets complicated. And how much of that's going to apply to lost income and how it's accounted for. Do 1099 employees count, or is it only for employees that are on the books, you're paying payroll taxes and providing benefits and the like?
It's only W-2 employees. 1099s do not count as far as the calculation.
How do they calculate things such as payroll expenses for Schedule C filers, since these funds are already known for this group as owner compensation replacement?
Well, you take the Schedule C net income. It's limited to $100,000, and then you divide by 12 to come up with the monthly income. And that's then what you're able to replace is 2.5 months.
How do you show that was actually replaced? If that makes sense. I'm not sure if I asked that most clearly. What do you have to do with that money? If you're self-employed and you're not doing it with paying paychecks to other people, how do you show what, how does somebody, a professional that's listening or the like, the doctor or the dentist who had to shut down their practice for the time being, so they've got lost income, but the only person they're paying is themselves. How is it determined what, how they have to document the lost income, or do they simply just take it and not have to document it?
I don't know that they have to necessarily document the lost income. What they do have to document is that it was used for the appropriate purpose. So that gets back to my original comment about isolating the funds and being able to trace it both in and out of a particular account. So they can't, if the sole practitioner or sole proprietor has received X number of dollars and for the next 2.5 months is, for lack of a better term, paying themselves, that's just got to be accounted for properly. But I don't know that they have to, unless David knows better than I do, I don't know that they have to substantiate that they're using it for a particular purpose apart from a withdrawal from their own, for their own purposes. That, right. That is the analogous equivalent of a wage.
And I think what Frank's original suggestion about having the separate account, then you write a check from that to your own personal bank account, not to your Schedule C business account, and then you've taken it and paid yourself for that lost income. I think that is probably the cleanest way you can do it.
Right, I agree. That is the cleanest way to do it.
What about somebody who operates out of their home? I know attorneys who don't necessarily maintain an office. They work out of their home. Can they potentially use 100% of the proceeds as owner compensation, or is there some amount that they're going to be limited because they're not paying for rent or other specific expenses that are set forth in the program?
Well, I can comment on that on a personal level. I have had a home office for 30-plus years. I didn't even bother to partake of the payroll protection loan because of the complexity and the potential issues that might come into play. So still, that doesn't mean that the person with a home office doesn't draw an income. So I'm not sure that that having a home office will affect whether or not a person can use the funds to pay themselves as opposed to paying rent.
Right. I think when looking again at the bottom line on your Schedule C, that's really the main factor. And if, again, it's paying up to, or you have to pay at least 75% related to the wage factor, and you don't have to, you could use 100% to reimburse employees or yourself the lost earnings and not have anything paid out for rent or mortgage, because it also covers mortgage.
But that's the mortgage for a business, not
business
personal.
Part, right? The business,
right? But
part.
You have to, if a person is computing the business use of home deduction, it's going, that portion of the borrowed funds will be used or should be used to pay the otherwise deductible portion of the home mortgage, or the prorated amount of the home mortgage principal and interest. And that's a computation that the sole practitioner or sole proprietor will have to do, or pay an accountant to do it. It's not going to be all that. It may not be all that easy. And there's what they save in taxes or what they save in terms of a forgiven loan, they will pay to some degree someone to assist them with this.
And are those amounts, I know those amounts can be written off your taxes if you're paying for, whether it's a tax preparer or an accountant, bookkeeper, whatever it may be, you can deduct those things. Can you deduct that from the amount you would pay back on this loan, or probably not?
No, well, if the loan is forgiven, you're not paying anything back on the loan, but to the extent that you've used the loan for the appropriate expenses, you're not going to be allowed a deduction at all. So if a person has paid, let's just keep the numbers fairly simple, if a person has paid $10,000 in mortgage interest from the payroll protection loan, that $10,000 of mortgage interest that would otherwise be deductible for the home office is not going to be deductible at all.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden. Tonight we're discussing the preparation, filing, and payment of your taxes. Joining me tonight are Pacifica attorney, accountant, realtor Frank Adam, and San Rafael attorney, accountant, CPA David Hellman. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of San Francisco, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. As always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topic. You're not limited to the exact point we are on the conversation. So please call us with any of your tax questions. This is Your Legal Rights. We'll be back right after this.
Support for KALW is provided in part by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information. 415-989-1616. A very good evening to you. I'm David LaTulipe with another number for you, 800-525-9917. It's the number for you to call to show your support for Your Legal Rights and local public radio in general. It's a very brief 3-day pledge drive that we're doing to raise the funds that we need to increase our coverage for you. While we're giving that increased coverage during the pandemic, we're still keeping you entertained and informed. We hope, as a companion, you value us and can offer some support. The number again, 800-525-9917, or online at kalw.org. Now back to Jeff Hayden and his guests for Your Legal Rights.
So we were talking a little bit about some of these programs and how you account for them and the like. And one of the things we were talking about is proof of spending. Other than earmarking the funds specifically, what type of proof of spending would be advisable? For example, some might charge it on credit cards, but isolate it. And others might be wanting to write checks. Is there anything that's particular that would be required, or for that matter, verboten?
I think as a practical matter, David, you want to go first?
No, go ahead.
Well, I think as a practical matter, if you're going to use a credit card to pay the expense, it's going to be very hard to argue that you use the borrowed funds to pay the appropriate expense. So in my opinion, and it's just an opinion, I wouldn't do that. With regard to paying the expenses from the borrowed money, I may sound like a broken record, but I'm going to go back to my first comment. Put those monies in a separate checking account and make sure that those checks are used for the appropriate expense. Don't complicate the matter trying to earn credit card points or whatever the motivation is for using a credit card, because now you've taken one bit of borrowed funds and using them to pay essentially another type of borrowed fund, namely the credit card bill. I would avoid that. It's going to make the accounting and the tracing of it more difficult, and it's going to be very problematic if there is a formal inquiry or audit. It's going to be complicated enough. I wouldn't add a layer of complexity to this.
David, do you agree?
Yes, I do. And one of the other point is that with all kinds of expenditures, you also have to have the paid bill. You need proof that the money was used, and the bill is what the IRS looks for in addition to the canceled check. or if it is done by credit card. But whatever it is, you need to have that invoice so that you've got proof where the money went. You know, it's like the old idea of somebody writing a check and putting it in the church plate for a donation and then taking money back out of the plate. Well, the government wants to make sure that if you've got a check that you've written to pay a bill, that there really is a bill there to substantiate where the money went.
And the bill should be in the taxpayer's possession upon payment of the bill. Don't pay the bill without having the invoice issued.
Right.
That is the law with regard to all expenses. The bill should be in the possession of the taxpayer upon payment.
One of the things you commented earlier is about monies that you pay within, I think you said, 60 days of receiving the funds. Does the forgiven money perhaps relate to funds that you expended earlier in the pandemic? So, for example, if you've been paying your rent and running out of money, will it look back to rent you've already paid, or does it really start from the day you get the money?
Now, my understanding is it starts when the money shows up, and then you've got the 60 days. You've got 8 weeks.
I don't know anything different than that.
So we were talking somewhat about taxes. We kind of strayed and talked a bit more about the payroll protection program. And we strayed a lot into people that are self-employed, that are Schedule C tax filers. What about some of the other businesses around that might operate differently? For example, somebody operates a restaurant. How might some of those rules differ when you have a business where they're actually writing paychecks to people? Small ones, but they're writing paychecks.
I don't know that the rule is going to differ at all. And a restaurant owner can also file a Schedule C. Not all restaurateurs are incorporated or have limited liability companies. But the rule and the procedure is going to be exactly the same. If it's a sole proprietor who runs a restaurant, isolate those funds, pay your employees and pay yourself, or pay your employees the appropriate wage from the borrowed funds. If you are an LLC or a corporation, and it's the corporation, of course, that's borrowing the funds, again, isolate those funds and have if you're using a payroll service, make sure that the payroll service draws from the borrowed money bank account the amount necessary to meet the payroll. I had a discussion about that with a client just this morning. And it's a fairly easy thing to do. The payroll services out there should be able to accommodate you as to which account they're going to draw the required funds for each payroll.
Yeah, there also is a new credit that came in with the CARES Act for keeping people employed during the pandemic that would otherwise have been laid off. So there is an economic credit. I think it's limited to $10,000, if I recall. But that's another thing that is available to people that are keeping people on the payroll.
We had a caller that called. David, I'm going to jump in. Your audio is cutting out momentarily. No, it looks like maybe mine is. Can you all hear me now?
I can hear fine.
Okay. Yeah. You cut out for a moment. I thought it was you, but it was actually at my end. We did have a caller that called and left a question that was not wanting to be heard on the air, that want their question asked, saying that this caller had established an EIN account, and perhaps you could, in a moment when you answer, explain what that is, but established an EIN account through the IRS for a family trust. She got the number but never ended up using it. She's concerned about her tax implications if she subsequently received funds intended for the trust, but she didn't want to stay on the air and really explain that, really, if that's the gist of what she wanted. Can you talk to us a little bit about that kind of a setup? First, what is an EIN?
Well, an EIN is an employer identification number. So I'm not sure what her question is. The trust has its own federal employer identification number, that's fine. I don't know how else to comment on that.
Right. I mean, it's not required unless it's an irrevocable trust. A normal revocable trust would normally use the social security number of one of the grantors.
So as I read her question, and again, I'm second guessing this because she's no longer on the phone. But as I understand it, I think what she's asking is that since she didn't go ahead and use that number, is there somehow that this money intended for the trust may be seen as if it went into her pocket?
Did she say whether or not she got any money?
She said she's concerned about her tax implications if she subsequently received funds that were intended for the trust.
Well, again, if the money that's received has got the EIN attached to it through a 1099, for instance, then whatever, if she has got a revocable trust, then my suggestion would be that if it's, let's just say, interest, that on the Schedule B where you list the interest income, you'd put down that it's from and reported on EIN number whatever. And that way there's a tracing ability if it's ever questioned. But I don't think there's a general tax problem with this. It just may require a little bit of additional paperwork on the reporting.
So as is often the case, it's really the ability to set up that it can be traced so that they can separate out money that was intended for the trust as opposed to what she may have kept for herself or was intended for her.
Right. Yeah, I mean, if it's an irrevocable trust, then it needs to file its own tax return, and everything that's trust income should be reported on that return.
Okay, I'm going to announce one last time, perhaps. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM. I am Jeff Hayden. I'm calling you via Zoom, so if we get momentarily interrupted, you'll know that we're doing the best we can with this broadcasting remotely. There's still a shelter-in-place order, and that keeps us where we are. Tonight, we're discussing the preparation, filing, and payment of your taxes. Joining me tonight are accountant attorney David Hellman from San Rafael and accountant realtor attorney Frank Adam of Pacifica. Both of these guests are very generous with their time and are more than happy to answer your questions if you call us. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of San Francisco, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. Again, that's 866-798-8255. And as always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topic, which, of course, tonight is taxes. You're not limited to exactly where we are in our conversation. You're not limited to anything. Call us on any question about tax filing and preparation, as did another caller, a couple that filed a 1040 but forgot to include some Social Security income. Preparer mentioned that they could file an amended return. Can you explain that a bit?
Sure.
Well,
go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
All right. So an amended return is where you've made a mistake. And you file this return. It's for federal, a 1040X. For California, it's a 540X schedule. It's part of the regular return. But you just report on that, whatever the change is, and recalculate your tax. And if you owe more, you pay it. If you do a refund, well, then that'll come through.
Let me turn it to Mike in San Francisco. Mike, welcome. You're on Your Legal Rights.
Hey, thank you very much. Good evening, guys. This is a very useful and interesting show, so thank you so much. Hey, my question, I'm a small business employer here in the city. And a while back, we had the CARES Act came out, and it was about using some sick pay or using that specific money that's earmarked towards sick pay, towards paying your employees. It was really not clear if you could just pay your employee sick time from that All the payroll systems allowed us to earmark it using that system. But then they came back 3 weeks later and said, no, you really weren't supposed to pay your employees through that sick time through the CARES Act unless they actually got COVID. So I was just curious if you guys have heard about this and if you have any recommendations for employers who might have done the right thing, or at least they thought they were acting in good faith to give their employees some sick time pay, but then it turns out it's not kosher after all. Just curious if you guys have heard about that.
Well, I think it depends on whether you're actually, if they have accrued sick time and you're charging against that, that I think is the issue that you're talking about. But the fact that you're paying them and keeping them employed or at least economically supported, then you're entitled to deduct those payments. And they're part of also the potential for getting this credit I mentioned a little earlier that came through the CARES Act also. I'm not sure if that fully answers your question.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's great. I guess what I sort of heard, and maybe I got the wrong information, was that, in fact, your employees are not eligible for that kind of a benefit if, for example, the next week they went on unemployment insurance or there's a competing sort of benefit, like you can't sort of double dip or whatever. So I'm just curious, the point I was trying to make was that credit was supposed to come up, in the next quarter or whatever, like you would get all of that money back as sort of a credit if you paid it all out up front. So I guess I just need to keep my eye on this or figure something out.
Right. I think you will be entitled to the credit, but you're also right about they cannot double dip.
Okay.
If people are on unemployment, then they can't be paid by you for their being sick with the COVID, being off work because of the COVID staying in place at home. But otherwise, you're entitled to the credit and they're entitled to get paid, but they can't double dip. And sometimes they make more money by staying on unemployment. But if you want to bring them back to work, if your shop opens, your business opens up again, you give them written notice that they should come back to work. And if they choose not to, well, then they're unemployed. And then they may have a problem collecting the unemployment because they were offered a job.
Gotcha.
This gets a little tricky for people.
Yeah, I also think the rules on this, on the CARES Act and the acts that follow, are really a moving target. In assisting clients with it so far, I know that at one point in time there was a particular criteria for applying for the payroll protection loan, and that criteria changed very soon after applications were submitted, and there were essentially two sets of rules. So this is a moving target. You're going to have to, like you said, keep your eye on it and deal with the issues when it comes time to prepare your 2020 tax returns or deal with the loan forgiveness process.
Great. Hey, can I ask you guys a quick follow-up question? Based on the payment protection loans, which in fact we did get, but we just got it fairly late in this whole process. So we got it, I think, 2 weeks ago. But the fact that our businesses are still closed, how, if there's like that stay in place order and you can't really reopen your business, and yet you only have so many weeks to actually like start paying your employees their payroll again to get that forgiven, have you guys heard anything about how that's supposed to work if you can't have your people there and pay them a payroll, and yet there's a time limit on when you're supposed to be using that money towards payroll? Do you have any insight on that?
Well, I think you can pay them if they're not on unemployment, and that would be a valid use of the money.
Even if they're not technically working.
Right.
Okay.
I mean, the whole idea of this thing is to keep people, with their economic status as best unfeathered as, changed as possible. But, and so that's part of the idea.
Gotcha. I was just confused that how do we go about paying people for working when all of our business, we're all supposed to not be in business at the moment. So just go ahead and pay them, run payroll as if they were working, and then that would be eligible potentially for the forgiveness.
Correct.
Right. Just keep in mind that the monies that you use that are forgiven are not going to be a deduction on your 2020 return.
Yeah, unless Congress changes that law.
Again, I mean,
this
yeah.
is what the IRS has said. A couple of Congress people were upset, so it may get thrown into whatever the next tax bill is.
And is that and how is that problematic in terms of tax bills and all of that? I mean, do you get a write off for payroll tax? Is that part of at the end of the year?
Yes, to the extent you're paying in payroll taxes, you normally do get that write off.
Gotcha. Interesting. In this case, they're saying that's not going to be a write off.
Well,
it's not the payroll tax, it's the payroll
not the tax,
expense.
The payroll itself
won't be deductible. But again, the $10,000 credit that David was talking about pertains to a refundable payroll tax credit. And again, all of these rules and the manner in which the rules will be applied are not exactly firm just yet.
Gotcha. It is sort of like changing a wheel while the car is still rolling, isn't it?
Yep.
Gotcha. Hey, listen, you guys, this is really useful. Thank you so much for your help.
Thank you for joining us. And let me turn to Martin in San Francisco. Martin, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Oh, hi. Is it me?
It's you. You're on the air.
Oh, okay. Well, this is a question which is a little bit maybe off the kilter here, but I hope you are going to help me. I just wonder, is it even possible to even ask that maybe if we will be able to file a federal or state income tax one day in the future on a postcard, like most of European, Western European countries, I will take the answer up there.
Yeah, my bet is no, because of all the lobbyists that are in Washington, D.C. and in Sacramento, because they are all looking for specific tax provisions, and those specific provisions always tend to have a separate form or a line, and it just gets to be too much.
Yeah, I agree. I wouldn't hold my breath about filing a tax return on something the size of a postcard. Our tax laws are complex, and despite the efforts at simplification, however well-intentioned, don't simplify the code, in my opinion.
Right. All of the talk is never, it just gets more and more complicated every year.
We had a caller that didn't stay on the air, but that asked the question that with the tax filing deadlines extended and with the time to pay your taxes extended, does that also extend time to make your IRA contribution?
I believe it does, doesn't it, David?
That is my understanding also. Now, you're limited to how much you can put in your IRA, but if you haven't paid it all in, you want to put more in up till you file the return, that's okay.
There's one other point I want to make. If it's an IRA, that's one thing. The deadline is July 15th. However, if it's an employment-related plan, like a SEP IRA or something along that line, and you haven't made the contribution by the July 15th, the new July 15th date, if you don't file an extension at that point, you're not going to be able to make the deduction later on. So if you need more time to file to pay that into that kind of plan, file the extension on July 15th and give yourself the extra, what is it,
three months.
And we should have time for one more caller, but we have to keep it kind of tight. But Rod from San Francisco, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi. I want to know the difference between buying something with the dollars down, say at my local brokerage, compared to buying something on the blockchain with Bitcoins. And it seems to me the difference mainly is that dollars are currency and you they're all lumped together, whether you buy it, whether you earn them, whenever you earn them. On the blockchain, I think that the government is going to call buying a Bitcoin an asset. And do you have to keep track of these individually, or can you have a wallet of Bitcoins and you take them out and it doesn't make any difference when you bought them?
No, you need to retain records about your basis in the Bitcoin, both that you purchased and when you used it to buy something or you sold them out. The government is, the IRS particularly, is getting very stringent on making people report all of this. In fact, there's now a question on your tax return if you do anything with virtual currency. They ask you that question on the return, and then that's going to set you up for future review by the government. So yeah, you need to keep track of, if you spend $100 to buy, you know, a 100th part of a Bitcoin, then you need to keep that as a track of your basis. And then if you ever sell it, then you know that you've got a $100 basis for that part of the Bitcoin you sold.
That would mean that if I made two Bitcoin purchases and sold $1.50 worth, not an even number on the purchase, I have to have two separate transactions recorded, one for each Bitcoin?
Not necessarily. You could combine them, but you need proof. So if you're ever audited, you could show that one of them you paid X for and the other you paid Y for.
Easily pool them, I guess. Yes.
Right. Yeah. I mean, think of them just like if you were selling stocks.
Yeah.
Same kind of records and same kind of treatment.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Kevin, thank you for joining us. And we are now out of time. I wanted to give each of you a minute or so for any closing thoughts or any advice you want to pass on. David, why don't I start with you?
Okay. Well, it's never too late to start preparing your taxes. The deadlines are going to come up sooner than you think. If you're using a professional, they need time. They can't get 50 different people showing up on July 15th and expect their returns are going to get done that day. And similarly, you're not going to, even if you're doing your own return, normally there are complexities that you don't anticipate. You may need to go dig for records. So start early and get yourself organized and get working on the returns.
Frank, any last thoughts?
Yeah, with regard to 2020, I think especially for business owners that do a more casual accounting, this year if you're going to partake of the payroll protection loan or any other governmental program, you may want to formalize your accounting procedures such that one, you can prepare the taxes more easily in 2021, and you can answer any audits or inquiries that may come your way, because I imagine at some point there will be inquiries about how this money was used. There's a lot of money out there, and I don't imagine the government is going to simply close its eyes as to the accounting for it. So there are lots of businesses that do a very informal job of keeping their books. This might be a good year to be a little more formal.
You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. Tonight we presented you this year's tax preparation and filing program. Our guests tonight have been Pacifica attorney, accountant, realtor Frank Adam, and from San Rafael attorney CPA David Hellman. Your Legal Rights will be back next week, where we are putting together a long-awaited landlord-tenant program. But David, Frank, let me thank you both for joining us.
You're welcome. Our pleasure.
Yeah, you're welcome. Glad to be here.
And our thanks to all of you for listening. And at the controls, David Latulippe, I am Jeff Hayden. Thank you, be safe, and have a good night.